Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you think of yourself as a good person, a decent person, a moral and honest human being, this hour of radio may be a rude awakening. According to one of our country's leading social scientists, you are probably, in fact, a cheater, a liar, maybe a thief, and definitely prone to half-truths. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely has taken a microscope to our more devious and self-deceptive ways. It's not easy, he says, to be immune. This hour on Point, why and when we lie and cheat. You can join the conversation. Can you, will you admit to yourself that sometimes you do it? Cheat, lie. Here's your chance to confess and explain and learn. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, is Dan Ariely. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and author of the new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dan Ariely, welcome back to On Point.
Well, my pleasure. Nice to talk to you again.
So we all do it? Who says? I mean, everybody? Really? Are you sure? Even the saints among us?
So I haven't tested the saints, but okay. I've tested lots and lots of people. And the reality is that, you know, we're taught to lie from a young age. Like, no parents ever tell their kids that they're right. Answer to the question, honey, how do I look in that dress, is to tell the whole truth.
I don't think my wife asked my kids about that, though. I mean,
but, you know, the reality is that we do understand that there's lots of human values. Honesty is one of them, and that sometimes we need to trade them off. We tell people not to tell the whole truth. We tell them to balance things between being truthful and not hurting somebody else's feeling. And on top of that, we have a biased worldview. So imagine something like the following. Imagine that you go to a sports event and you're a big fan of some team, and the referee calls a call against your team. Ask yourself whether you could see reality in an objective way or whether you would nevertheless see it from the perspective that you want to see it, whether you would not be able to help but think the referee is an idiot, vicious, blind, something like that. And if you take this perspective, and most sports fans realize that, now ask yourself what happened if you replace liking a particular team with lots of money on that one hand. Ask yourself whether you wouldn't be able to be biased because you can get paid to see the world in one view rather than the other one. So when we look at the world, we tend to look at the world as kind of good people and bad people. And we say, as long as we just keep away from bad people, everything would be correct. But what we've discovered is that if you put people in conflicts of interest, if I pay you to see the world in a different way, you would be able to do it. Not fully, but to a little degree.
And we all have interests of one kind or another, I guess, in our daily lives.
Yep. And the big issue turns out to be rationalization. So the standard view of economic theory is very simple. It says you just think about the cost and benefit. You say to yourself, how much money can I stand to gain if I steal this particular thing? What do I stand to lose? What's the chance I'll be caught? How much time will I get in prison? The reality is that people don't think about the long-term consequences. Both in terms of the research I've done and also when I talk to big, serious criminals, nobody ever think about the long-term consequences of their actions. Instead, what happened is that you ask yourself, can you rationalize this behavior? And to the extent that we can rationalize the particular behavior, we're much more likely to do it.
You think that people have more lying and cheating in their lives than they may admit or even be conscious of. And as you describe it, it's not always those little lies of kindness, the not to hurt with the truth. Yeah. You know, it's often reaching for some personal benefit or some personal gain in your description. Give us some examples of lying and cheating that softly, quietly come into people's lives. They may not even be identifying these as lying and cheating.
That's exactly right. People might not think of those. Think about downloading illegal stuff from the internet. When I ask young people about this, virtually everybody does that, but they don't think about it as being dishonest. In fact, recently somebody, a 22-year-old, told me why this is actually a good thing to do. He said that musicians actually want the music to be heard. That's why they started doing it in the first place. And music label, he said, were evil and bad companies, and he shouldn't pay them any money. And on top of that, he said that everybody is doing it, and he wouldn't have paid for it anyway, so he's not hurting anybody directly. So here's a case where somebody completely created a wall of rationalization around their actions, and this is something incredibly, incredibly common. Now, on the other hand, you can think about what happens with expense reports and how people think about expense reports. And it turns out expense report also has lots of fluidity and ways to rationalize things. What is actually acceptable? What is not acceptable? I'll give you one great example that we did about golf. So we did a study
golf,
with about...
as in out on the greens, okay.
Yeah. We did a study with about 12,000 golf players. And we said, imagine that your ball falls in a particular point and you really wished it would move by 4 inches. You wanted it to be in a slightly different spot.
It would
spot.
Make it so much easier if it was 4 inches left
so
or right.
So much easier. Yeah. And then we said, how would you feel about picking it up and moving it by 4 inches? Okay. And people said, oh, this is just awful. This is just awful. I would never do it. Nobody would ever do it. I never heard of anybody doing it. Just morally outrageous. Then we said, what about kicking it with your shoe a little bit? I said, oh, that's much more likely. I can see myself doing it, and definitely I can see other people doing it. And what about moving it a little bit with your club? All of a sudden, say, oh, yeah, this is actually quite easy.
It's the same 4 inches, just to, what, because they're not putting their hand on the ball to move it, it's not the same cheat.
Exactly. The moment there's more distance between us and our actions, it's easier to basically make the action but don't think of ourselves as bad people. You know, in the same way that you think about illegal downloads and how easy it is to do it because we don't see the consequences of our actions. In the last year or so, every time I go to a restaurant, I always ask the waiter if they can think about ways to eat a nice meal there and slip away without paying. And I said, don't worry, I'm not going to do it. Just kind of, if I wanted to do it, how would you advise me to do it?
Okay.
And they always give me some really good suggestions. Actually, aside from one time that the waiter didn't give me a good suggestion, they always have good suggestions of how you can basically just slip away. And I'm not recommending doing that, of course.
Please, no.
But I asked them, how often does it really happen? And they say, almost never. And they say sometimes somebody walks without paying the bill, but if they catch him and they ask him, they said they just forgot about paying it. Yeah. It was not intentional. And you can ask yourself, what is the difference between not paying in a restaurant and the difference between downloading illegal stuff from the internet? And I think it's very much like the golf story, where it's the distance from their action. When you sit there in the restaurant and you see somebody serving you and you see the food and you consume it and so on, there's no way for you not to think that you're doing something immoral by not paying. But when you're doing it on the net, not really a big problem. You can justify it in all kinds of ways, and because of that, we're likely to do it to a higher degree.
So maybe you're suggesting that we're not naturally liars and cheaters. If it's right in front of us and it's very plain, we're not prone to do it. It's only when it's kind of behind a screen or wall or distance so we can maybe more than deny, maybe we even don't pay attention to the moral factor.
Yeah, I think the first thing to realize is that we are better than economists would say we are. The truth is that we have lots and lots of chances to steal all day long. If you think about walking around the studio today, you can probably find all kinds of things you could take home and nobody would ever know and you would not suffer any consequences because of that. But something inside of us stops us from behaving badly, even when nobody would find out. And now the question is, what is it about this something inside of us that stops us? And when does it work to a higher degree and when does it work to a lower degree? And as we move to situations where we can justify to a higher degree, we're more likely to be dishonest. So let me kind of describe to you this one experiment we did on distance from cheating, which I think is very both illustrative and worrisome. So in the basic experiment, we do the following. We give people a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems, and we say, go ahead and solve as many of those as you can in the next 5 minutes. And we'll pay you $1 per question. They work as hard as they can. At the end of the 5 minutes, we say, stop, count how many questions you got correctly, and now go to the back of the room and shred that piece of paper. And then come to the front of the room and tell us how many questions you got correctly. People do that. In the first experiment, they reported they solved 6 problems. We paid them $6. But what people in the experiment don't know is that we played with a shredder. So the shredder only shred the sides of the page, but the main body of the page remains intact, and we can jump in and we can find out how many questions people really solve correctly. And what do we find? In general, people solve four problems and report to be solving six.
Four out of how many? Out of 20?
Four out of 20.
But they think it's shredded, so they could tell you that they solved 20 problems and they'd get more money.
That's right. But they cheat just by a little bit. So in the whole book, I describe experiments with about 30,000 people. And from those 30,000 people, we found about 12 people who were big cheaters. And they stole about $150 from me. Right, overreported dramatically.
Okay, okay.
But, and we found about 18,000 little cheaters, and they stole about $36,000 from me. And I think this is probably a good reflection on society. Yes, there are some big cheaters out there, people who break an entry and so on, and plan and execute some dishonest acts. But in relatively speaking, thankfully, they're a small part of the economic activity. And most of the dishonesty comes from people who just cheat a little bit here and there, and still think of themselves as good people. Now, here is how it moves to the distance we talked about earlier. So imagine that you are in the same experiment, but now instead of coming at the end and saying, "Mr. Experimenter, I solved six problems, give me $6, you ask for tokens. You say, "Mr. Experimenter, I solved such and such number of problems, give me such and such number of tokens."
Not cash, but just a token you could trade for cash later.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You take it, you take the tokens, you walk 12 feet to the side, and you change it for dollars.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Our participant doubled their cheating. And this, by the way, I think is the most worrisome result we've ever got in any of our experiments.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about why we cheat, why we lie, when we cheat, when we lie. My guest is Dan Ariely, professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and author of the new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dan, what is the break when people don't cheat as much as they could? Why not? What did you find was the resistance that they found in themselves or around themselves to just going whole hog?
So this is what we think of as a conscience or a moral compass. It's basically about when do you feel bad about your action. And what's interesting about feeling bad about our action is that it's something kind of fuzzy in general that is sensitive to the conditions of the environment. So, for example, what do you think would happen if you thought to yourself that everybody else is doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's easier to rationalize. Now you can say to yourself, well, if other people are doing it, that's okay as well. So we did an experiment like this. We got somebody to cheat in an egregious way. They basically cheated the whole thing. They took all the money and they went home and everybody realized that they were cheating in an egregious way.
Okay.
What happened now? Lots of other people cheated as well. Now, here's the thing. When you see somebody cheat in an egregious way, you can say to yourself, oh, in this experiment, you can cheat and get away with it. There's no cost to cheating. Or you can say to yourself, oh, it's socially acceptable. People like me are doing it as well. So to distinguish between these two theories, what we did was we dressed the acting student in a different uniform.
Okay.
This experiment we ran at Carnegie Mellon. Everybody was a Carnegie Mellon student, mm-hmm. and the acting student was a Carnegie Mellon student. In the other experiment, we dressed him in University of Pittsburgh sweatshirt. Now imagine what happens when you're a University of Carnegie Mellon student, but you see somebody from Pittsburgh cheating in
your
a
your rival. Way. Yeah, okay.
Your rival. You still learn that in this experiment you can cheat and get away with it. From the cost-benefit analysis, you can just get away. But it doesn't give you the social justification. Because now it's not people from your social group who are cheating. It's these other people you don't like as much.
But this suggests that if you're in a culture of cheating and you identify people who share your culture with that cheating, you're more likely to cheat yourself. So overall, do you have a sense, are we today, I don't know, in this country or you name the corner of it, are we in a large culture of cheating and lying or a culture of resistance to that?
I think we're in a culture of cheating to a higher degree. And I think there's a couple of contributors there. Right, so just to finish the experiment, mm-hmm. so when somebody from University of Pittsburgh cheats, people don't cheat more. They actually cheat less, right? But it's only when somebody is from their university that they get assigned for cheating, their own crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about something like the Greek financial crisis. Mm-hmm. Here's a group of people that haven't paid taxes for many, many years. And on top of that, here's a government who's clearly cooked the books when they applied for the European Union. And now the question is, why would they ever change? What would they stop that? It became a social norm. They all know that it's not legal, not to pay taxes, but nobody else is doing it. And the social proof around not paying taxes is incredibly, incredibly high, giving them a different sense of what's acceptable and not acceptable. And if you think about it, what's really driving our day-to-day behavior is not so much the actual legality, but it's what is acceptable in society.
What's acceptable? I mean, it seems lately like a lot is acceptable. I read carefully your study where you were looking at people who could have cheated more but didn't. And now by cheating, they'd get 50 cents more or a dollar more or maybe $5 or $10 more. But it was all small money that you were dealing with, right?
Yeah.
What if, I mean, I wondered if this study really proved out about human behavior. Take it into our financial system, and instead of having it be $5 or $10, make it $5 million or $10 million or $100 million. Does it work the same at that scale of, you know, payoff for the cheat? Maybe people weren't cheating in your study as much as they might have because the payoff was picayune, small.
So let me tell you a couple of answers for this. First of all, you know, if you want to fund a study when we can give people millions of dollars, I'm open
no,
to that.
Maybe we have one going on right now on Wall Street. I don't know.
Yeah. The second answer is we did one experiment to try and address that. Every time we try to do experiments with paying people lots of money and we don't have the budget to afford that, we go to India. And in India, we can, you know, pay in our money small amounts. It would look high there. So we did a study when people in 5 minutes couldn't get up to $2,000. Basically, every question was equal about $100 in local currency. Mm-hmm. And what we found in that experiment was no cheating whatsoever. Now, one interpretation of this is the people in India just don't cheat. And you can think about your own view on that. The second interpretation is that you can't cheat a little bit by cheating $100. That if every step is just too large, people can't cheat a little bit and feel good about themselves. And I suspect that this is the right account. Now, on top of that, I think the third answer is that in addition to the lab research, which is correct, I mean, it is about small amounts of money, relatively speaking, I've been talking to lots of big cheaters, people who've been in prison for all kinds of white-collar crimes, embezzlement, fraud, accounting fraud, insider trading, and so on. Mm-hmm. And none of them, I mean, the story for all of them is basically the same story. It's a story about one small step that they could rationalize. And this first step was actually, in many cases, not for their own benefit. It was for their companies or for a friend or under some social contract. And then after doing one step, they kind of rationalized. And it was easier to take the next step and the next step and the next step until it really got to be something they couldn't handle anymore. It was too large. And then they started trying to hide it in a much more thoughtful and deceptive way.
And yet most people don't go down that path, as you described. They may move their golf ball 4 inches with the putter or the club, but they don't become major league embezzlers.
So we need to ask ourselves whether it's about us or whether it's about the conditions. So imagine the following. So we said already that when other people around you are doing it, you're more likely to do it. Mm-hmm. And when something is multiple steps removed from money, you're more likely to do it as well. Mm-hmm. Now imagine that I put you in Wall Street about 10 years ago. And I would pay you $5 million a year if you could only see mortgage-backed securities as a good product.
Yeah.
Ask yourself, with that amount of payment and motivation, wouldn't you be able to see them as slightly better than they are? And now on top of that, imagine that everybody around you, who is your friends and colleagues and work together, also thought that mortgage-backed security were a good product because they were under the same incentives. And then on top of that, imagine they were difficult to compute and calculate and mm-hmm. figure out exactly. And you were sitting there with a big Excel spreadsheet and you could change all kind of parameters and you would see the final valuation at the end. And it would also affect your end of year bonus.
Right. Your bonus is growing and growing. They're looking better and better. They're looking more and more just.
Yeah. And, you know, it's easy to blame other people. But try to put yourself in that situation with the social pressure and the excitement over it and the difficulty of computing them and the distance from money, right? Because the distance is just incredible. You don't really see who you're hurting.
The bonus comes later. But you know that bonus will come if all these numbers get very big.
Yeah. And now think to yourself, who among us would be immune from seeing reality at least slightly distorted? You know, maybe people would vary to how much distorted they could look at it. But seeing, preventing ourselves from seeing any distortion, I don't think many of us are able to overcome these pressures.
What's the lesson in this? What's the lesson in this then on how to structure our society so we don't take the kind of enormous blow to the whole global economy that came out of that particular situation?
So I think there's a couple of lessons. The first lesson is that conflicts of interest are inherently terrible, right? And that's one lesson we haven't learned about financial crisis. The financial crisis, in my view, the mortgage issue was a side effect. It was a symptom. It was not the cause. The cause was a deep-rooted conflicts of interest. So we have to try and eliminate conflicts of interest from medicine, from finance, and so on, lobbying in Washington and so on. The second lesson is that we, as human beings, we try to create very fuzzy laws, very fuzzy rules that allow people to be flexible because we appreciate the benefit of gray zones. We say every time we have a gray zone, people can do whatever is right for them. At the same time, gray zones tempt people to see things in a way that suits them in the short term. By the way, not necessarily even suits them in the long term, just suits them in the short term to see that. And finally, so I think we should eliminate gray zones in all kinds of things like accounting and banking and so on.
Hard to do, but it would be
hard to do.
Powerful.
And finally, I think that there is a really good lesson about the good side of human behavior. So when we try to reduce the amount of cheating, we've tried all kinds of things. For example, in one experiment, we asked people to try and recall the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And we did this at UCLA in California. And none of the 500 students we asked could recall all Ten Commandments. And many of them invented new interesting commandments.
Okay.
But nevertheless, after trying to recall the Ten Commandments, nobody cheated. Right? And it's not as if the people who remembered more commandments, the people who are presumably more religious, cheated less, and the people who could hardly remember any commandments cheated more. Nobody cheated. Even when we take self-declared atheists and we ask them to swear on the Bible, and then we give them a chance to cheat, they don't cheat.
So just thinking about icons of morality or law or the notion of high morality put some kind of brake on their tendency to cheat?
That's right. And I think that if we thought about this and we said, okay, how do we create rules and standards of ethics and how do we create professional codes of ethics and how do we remind people at the time that they're doing those things that somebody's actually getting hurt? Like you look at all the terrible things we see in banking and you ask yourself, are bankers really terrible people or we put them in terrible situations? I think we put them in terrible situations. And because of that, I think we need to think about the immediate temptation and how we can counteract.
A terrible situation? They sit in front of a computer screen and make a bonus of $10 million.
It's a fantastic situation from a selfish perspective of making money, but I think it's unrealistic of us to expect them to be honest in that situation. So, you know, I think that you could take you and me and put us in that situation for a few years and we would just behave as badly as everybody else.
Now, pretty soon we'll be the CEO of Barclays Bank manipulating interest rates. Okay, off we go.
You know, I think there's some levels that things become difficult and extreme and some people know that they're doing bad things. And it's hard to know if the CEO of Barclays knew it or not. But I think the human capacity for misbehavior is really much broader than we think. It's more general. And because of that, we need to think about what environment do we create that would hopefully limit these misbehaviors.
I want to look more at that. We've got a lot of our listeners calling in with examples and questions and life experience of their own. Dan Ariely joins us from Duke University. His new book is The Honest Truth about Dishonesty. Dan, stand by there in Durham, North Carolina. Jason's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi. I confess I'm both a liar and a thief.
Okay.
And I don't steal anymore, and I try not to lie. But during the program, as I was listening, I realized that the psychological dynamic was the same. At first, it was kind of, oh, let's just try this and see if I can get away with it.
What were you lying about or stealing, Jason?
Okay, I'll give you an example of each. I told my girlfriend once that I had been married, that I had kids. And this was on different occasions, and eventually it got huge. Like, I had seven kids, and they were taken by DSS, and they lived in Tennessee. And finally, when I told her the truth, she wouldn't talk to me for a week.
Did you think it would endear you to her to say you'd been married and had seven kids you'd walked away from?
I must have been out of my mind. I think I just wanted to see how much more I could get away with.
Okay.
And it was the same with feeling. I stole like a $2 wrench from Sears Roebuck, and it was like, oh, I have a secret. They don't know I have a wrench in my pocket. And it had to end because I stole an entire car battery. I left the store with a car battery.
That's heavy.
You can't run carrying a 40-pound car battery. And I drove away, and the guy's running down the street after me, and I see him in my rearview mirror. Oh. And I said, it was only then that I said, this has got to stop.
And did you stop after having tasted the cheating apple, the stealing apple?
The fear, the terror overcame the like adrenaline terror of running with the battery overcame the ha ha I got away with it thing. Really, it was really scary.
So are you on the straight and narrow now, Jason, or still thinking?
Yes, I am. I've been in 12-step programs for a long time, and you know the thing about rigorous honesty is like. Made me conform to being honest and not steal. And if I do, if I lie, or if I, you know, scam a little change at the register, I get right about it. I say so.
Rigorous honesty. We like the phrase and we like the fact, and I'm glad you shared that with us. Dan, what do you hear in Jason's story?
So there's a couple of interesting things. First of all, the lying to the girlfriend and kind of a slippery slope and then just starting from one thing and then have to cover it back up and so on. That turns out to be a very common symptoms for big cheaters. Lots of accounting frauds start like this, with something small for just one quarter for some particular reason that looked good at the moment, but then it just gets worse and worse and worse until it's basically kind of such a scheme of lies that is not possible. The other thing that I would like to comment on is this idea of 12 steps. So
we usually think of that in the relation to alcohol or drug problems.
That's right. So think about Alcoholic Anonymous. One of the rules that they have is no alcohol at all. And you can ask yourself, why not have a rule that says you can have half a glass a day or a quarter of a glass a day? Why not have such a rule like that? And the reason is that if you have a rule that says half a glass a day, all of a sudden the glass would become very big.
Yes.
Or you would say to yourself, oh, I didn't have one from yesterday, I can have one today. Or this one is for the next whole week, and next week I would not have any of them. The moment we have fuzzy rules, we can basically lie to ourselves. It's not about being bad people. It's about kind of the moral flexibility we can show. And because of that, incredibly strict rules are actually central in order to get good behavior.
How do you do that in a political culture like the United States? We put a very high premium on freedom. And strict rules and lots of rules are often thought of as in contradiction with that idea of freedom.
So my hope is that if we understood the downside of freedom, which in this case is, mental lying gymnastics, I think we might stop it to some degree. I think that the moment we understand the cost of it, we would take it more cautiously.
I think Americans might go the other way and say, you know, freedom is so important that we're actually willing to deal with a little bit of cheating and lying around the edges in order to stay free at the heart of the equation.
The problem is that it's not so little, right? The amount of cheating that we get as a consequence of it is not so little. So the moment we have a banking system, for example, that is not highly regulated, or the moment we have a lobbying system in Washington that is not highly regulated and very clear about what people can and can't do, we get ourselves into tremendous problems. And I think we're starting to understand the magnitude of how much trouble we got ourselves into with this flexibility, and I'm hoping that we're going to try and reverse this to some degree. Now, if somebody has no conflicts of interest, let's say an artist can be as much flexibility as they want because they can't really cause much damage. Politicians, we should be more careful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why we cheat, why we lie, and when we cheat, and when we lie, with Dan Ariely, behavioral economist at Duke University, author of the new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan, here's an email or online question or comment from a listener. Carrie says, a rising junior at the University of Virginia transferred there from Connecticut College. She writes, both schools abide by an honor code. You have to write out and sign a pledge not to cheat or lie on assignments and tests. However, Carrie writes, I've witnessed cheating on both campuses in a variety of forms. So here it is. There's the clear expectation, Dan. They ask people to actively sign on, you know, read it, write it, sign it, and still, Carrie says, seen it both places.
So a couple of things. First of all, we have done experiments on the honor code, and the good news is that it works. So we did this experiment both at MIT and at Yale, and we got students to sign an honor code that says, I understand that this short experiment falls under the MIT or Yale honor code. Mm-hmm. And what happened after that? We saw no cheating whatsoever.
Zero in your case, but not in our listener Carrie's experience.
That's right. Zero in our case. And that's, by the way, despite the fact that neither MIT nor Yale have an honor code.
Okay.
So people signed something that was actually without any force behind it, and nevertheless, they became much more honest. Now, what we need to understand is the honor code and signing an honor code is one force. I think it does get people to think about their morality. It gets them to think about it to a higher degree. Mm-hmm. The question is, will it have the power to overcome other forces? So, for example, we talked earlier about the social force. If you see other people around you behaving badly, you're more likely to behave badly as well. So I think in a culture where cheating is rampant and everybody else is doing it, adding an honor code is probably not going to do it. You need to do something else in addition. At the same time, I do think that cheating in those schools would have probably been higher without the honor code. But now what they need to do is the honor code is clearly not a sufficient remedy for that. They need to do something else in addition to that and hopefully get the school into a good track and then continue with the honor code. So here's kind of one possible direction.
Mm-hmm.
We did a study on the Catholic confession. I'm not a Catholic myself, but I was very interested in this idea of asking for forgiveness and getting forgiveness, and what does it do?
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is the Catholic confession actually decreases cheating. So in some experiments, we get people to cheat. They cheat a little bit, and then over time, the slippery slope starts kicking in, and they start cheating more and more and more. And at some point, they cheat all the time. And then we give people a chance to do the kind of our version of the Catholic confession. Write here, please, what you've done badly, what you regret doing, then shred the piece of paper for real, we don't want to see it, and then ask for forgiveness from whatever deity you believe in, and people do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And after both of those things, what happened? It's as if people are starting a new page. They open a new page, and the dishonesty level goes down, not to zero, but it goes down to a pre-confession levels.
That's amazing. You describe it as a kind of a reset. And why is that? Because mm-hmm. now that they've made a clean breast of it, they don't want to soil their new pristine record?
That's right. So we view ourselves as honest, and we take pride in viewing ourselves as honest. We have a value in doing that. But at the same time, once you start behaving badly, you can't think of yourself as being honest. So if you've cheated on two exams, why not cheat on the third and fourth? You're not getting any benefit from that. But confession does help to reset kind of pages. And you can think about the Reconciliation Act in South Africa as part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That basically a whole nation said, here is what we've done terribly wrong. We're sorry about that. Let's start a new page. And, you know, it doesn't start a new page automatically, but I think it helps move to a higher degree.
More confession and maybe more blank slates that people don't want to mess with.
It's basically a new starting point.
Mm-hmm.
The third question, I think, for Carrie is a question of where this has already become part of society. So if you think about the differences between downloading illegal material and between stealing from a restaurant, if you took a common undergrad these days and you told them, how bad would you feel if the New York Times had a story that you didn't pay in a restaurant and you escaped without paying, they said they will be incredibly embarrassed. But you say, how embarrassed would you be if you were caught downloading illegal material? They say, I wouldn't care at all. My friends would not look badly at me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a question of what is academic cheating. And I'm, as a professor, I'm actually worried that academic cheating is becoming closer and closer to looking like online downloads, that the moral component, what holds us back, if you think about guilt or feeling bad about it, that's basically what holds us back without probability of being caught or punishment and so on. Mm-hmm. It's our internal moral conscience. And I think that it's going away a little bit.
Why would that be? I mean, I've got listeners here writing. Paj writes, says, as a teacher, I'm lied to all the time. Many kids today feel if they can get away with lying, it isn't really bad. By the way, some of their parents have no problem backing up their kids' lies, too.
Yeah.
Is this really changing? Why would that be?
So I think there's a tendency for this deterioration because, you know, we do want to be – we have an impulse to be dishonest in this case to our personal benefit. In the book, I describe the probability of grandmothers dying just before a final exam, which is quite dramatic. And not only that, it turns out that grandmother dies very often for kids who are not doing well in school.
This excuse emerges for not being prepared. Yeah.
But I think we see the benefits in those cases. You know, the kids get a benefit. They get the better grades. The parents are pushing them to get the grades without the consequences. And it's becoming socially acceptable, because if you think about what signals we're getting from society, the signals we're getting from society are for the bad behavior, not the good behavior. You know, we have stories out there about athletes who are doping, or bankers who are misbehaving, or people who are cheating in school. We don't have the story about the kids who are not cheating in school, and the athletes who are not doping, and the bankers who are behaving well. So every time we get this news, it's a little bit like the experiment on one person cheats in a kind of extreme way. We get signal from society that other people are doing it as well. And that, I think, becomes more and more normative, not in the economic sense, but in the sense that everybody else is doing it. So you look at the news, and you said to yourself, all teachers seem to be lying. All students seem to be lying. My kid is the only one behind who is not seem to benefit from that. And they have to catch up. They have to do it just to catch up. I'll give you a different example for this. One of my friends was getting into online dating. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking about how to represent his age. And he was in the 35-plus category. But he said everybody lies in their age. So he is actually going to penalize himself for putting himself in the correct age. So
suddenly
he has to basically...
34.
That's right. Just to be correct with everybody else. So I think there is this trend. Or another way to think about this trend is to think about corruption. What is corruption? Corruption is a case where people know it's not okay to bribe a policeman. That's not what the rules say. But everybody else does it. And because everybody
Where?
Else does
Who?
It.
I'm not so familiar with that problem.
Not so much in Boston. But you know, if you think about Africa, you think about other countries, there's all kinds of ways of corruption. How do you pay an official to get this, or you pay a policeman to get this, and so on. And as this form of corruption become more acceptable, it doesn't make it legal, and everybody knows it's illegal to the same degree, but because everybody knows that this is how you do it, you have to do it this way. And I think there's more and more cheating in school that basically is becoming like that. Now, I don't think we're behind the point of no return, but I think it's a very dangerous trend that we're going down, and we have to do something quite substantial to reverse it.
Dan Ariely, we've got a big line at the confessional booth here for you. If I may bring a couple more in. Wesley in Ocean Park, Maine. Wesley, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, John. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've long written term papers for people for very nominal amounts of money. I'd never think of letting somebody write a term paper for me. I'd gladly help somebody who needed it cheat on a test, and yet I'd walk away immediately if I were given an opportunity to cheat on a test myself. And I also, for me, cheating is almost kind of a discipline. I can't play a game without trying to cheat, often in very elaborate ways, any kind of workshop game or anything.
Why do you think you're so given to this, Wesley? Why?
I there's something in undermining a system, in undermining an ethical and sometimes false ethical system by showing how absolutely contradictory and bankrupt it is. Hence, many games have very arbitrary rules to find new and elaborate ways to break those rules and thereby discredit the game I get a real joy out of it.
So you're sort of smarter than the system, and therefore this is a way to mock or reveal its flaws.
I guess I never thought of myself as smarter than the system. Just I get a kind of a kick out of seeing the system stumble over itself.
Yeah, competitive cheater there, Wesley. We've got it. Let's get Dan's hearing of your confession.
So Wesley basically has kind of two theories that could explain what he's doing. One is, as you said, he's trying to outsmart the system, and he's also explained this in his own world. He's basically trying to show that this is a bad system, that is arbitrary and not reasonable, and it should be done differently. The other one is that you say that he just is following his selfish interest and he's just trying to justify it. So we tried to do an experiment in which we gave people a chance to basically trick the system and show them they are better than the system and show them whether the people would cheat more. We couldn't find any evidence for that. Now, you know, we ran this experiment in Iowa, so maybe the people in Iowa are not interested in showing that they're smarter than the system. But mostly I think that what Wesley is really doing is rationalizing it. He's finding all kinds of reasons to say what he's doing is okay. So in the case of taking exams from other people and doing essays from them, he's clearly making money out of this and making money in a way that is not according to the law, and he's helping other people break the law. But he's basically been able to justify it by saying that he doesn't do it unless it's for a good reason, because he's showing people that the rules they're creating and so on. It just tells you that human rationalization is really quite fantastic, and people can tell themselves all kinds of wonderful story. I'll tell you one other one that was we ran in Boston, actually. So we came to people in Boston in a coffee shop and we said, hey, would you be willing to do an experiment for 5 minutes for $5? And they said yes. And at the end of the 5 minutes, we came to them and we said, here's your $5. Please count it and sign a receipt. But we actually gave them $9. And now the question is, how many Bostonians would return the extra money?
We're waiting.
And slightly more than 50% of the people returned the money. That's good news. In the other condition, though, when the research assistant explained to them the procedure, he pretended somebody called him up. He picked up his phone and he talked to John for 12 seconds about pizza.
Okay.
Put his phone back, kept on explaining it. What happened now? Now just about 10% returned the money. The moment we annoyed people, people said, oh, these are kind of bad people that are doing the experiment to me. They annoyed me. I'm actually restoring karma. I'm doing something good for the world by punishing them, because this is actually... And it's all about rationalization. And in general, you can think about cheating and you can ask yourself, what kind of things would change rationalization? Distance from money, other people are doing it, I'm doing something good, I'm helping somebody else, in fact, and so on. And all of those things would actually increase cheating, and everything you can think about that would decrease rationalization would actually decrease cheating.
If you can just decrease that rationalization. But I'm still thinking about our caller who's cheating at his board games because he's smarter than the system. The system's flawed. I wonder if a little bit of that goes into that perspective, runs into Wall Street as well. Beaufort, South Carolina. Doug, you're on the air, Doug. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What's your story?
Well, my concern is how empiricism is compromised by the deference of hierarchies that they enjoy, the deference that hierarchies enjoy.
Okay.
And so I'm a school psychologist, and I've been thinking about this at depth, in that we talk about the people on the lower rungs of these social hierarchies, you know, why they would cheat or steal, or why people would lie about how much fish they caught and all these types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the bigger picture is, just like your guest had mentioned, is the context, the social context. And the systems of man, particularly in psychology, right, are the ones that are giving everybody the impression that everybody else is doing it. And, you know, you can look at Harvey Milgram's research to see how unfortunate the state of affairs is when, back in the 60s, 65% of the people, of the subjects, of 1,000 people subject, were willing to deliver a potentially lethal electrical vote against these actors who are agonizing.
Right.
Because there was an authority figure in the back saying, you must do it for the sake of research. So it's like a two-thirds, one-third unfortunate bias that people, that seems to be clouding the empirical evaluation of truth.
Especially if they see that sort of openness to cheating associated with authority. Doug, let us hold that and get one more, if I may. Michelle in Rutland, Vermont. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a feel-good story.
Okay.
My husband had a very good job, great salary, great benefits. He found out that they were selling a product. They were misrepresenting it. It was not doing what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he resigned. All on moral standing. He could not sell a product.
He didn't. He didn't need the income. Were you independently wealthy? I mean, you had no bills to pay.
Well, he did say perhaps he did it backwards and probably should have found another job before he resigned. But because he's a really good, upstanding man, he immediately got two two job offers and is back to work after 2 weeks.
Michelle, I love that story. Do you think of your husband as an especially honest guy, or do you think there's more honesty in our world than we're maybe giving credit to today?
No, unfortunately, I think he is an especially honest man. Unfortunately, because that speaks to society.
Well, congratulations, though, to him and to you, Michelle. Thanks for sharing that upright story with us. Dan, what about those who are going to actually take the hit for honesty here, even at personal cost?
So I've talked to some people, and I don't know Michelle's husband, but I've talked to some people who've basically took very serious steps against misbehavior. And I asked them to reflect on what would happen if it didn't come all at once. What would have happened if it came small step by small step? And many of them said that if it came small step by small step, they probably wouldn't have taken the same degree. So there are people who are more honest than other people. There's no question about it. But what we need to think about is, what would we do if it was just small step one after the other? And finally, I want to say one last thing, mm-hmm. which is, it turns out with phishing, which the previous caller mentioned,
yeah.
it's okay to exaggerate by 25%. It's perfectly acceptable.
Anything over 25% and you're telling big fish stories, under, and you're just the norm. Dan Ariely, we really appreciate your investigation into this subject and the light you've shone on it with us today. The new book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan Ariely, Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Listeners, stay upright. Be true to your honest selves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.